All set?
Yep.
I call the special meeting of Thursday, January 7th to order. Councilmember O'Malley, would you lead us in the pledge to the flag, please?
Yes, please stand and join me.
Ready?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Kelly?
Here.
Councilmember Clay?
Yes.
Councilmember Barrow?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem O'Malley?
Here.
Mayor Fonzie?
Here.
All present.
Thank you, Marcia. And we are here tonight just for a management report, and this will be covering Strategic Planning 2010 Phase 2, which includes employee and labor relations. Staff report, please.
Mayor and Council, we're going to have a presentation on labor tonight. Jim Lewis is going to...
So you can follow along with us here. So this evening specifically we'll be discussing the roles that we each play, the unions, the management team, and the city council in the collective bargaining process. We'll be giving you an overview of labor relations laws as they pertain to California. There are several of them. We'll be giving you an overview of the current contracts that will be expiring on June 30th with all of our employee groups. We'll want to share with you some historical perspective on benefits and raises that have been provided to our employees over the last several years. We want to discuss with you some labor trends in California. These are definitely unprecedented times for local governments, and so we want to share some thoughts with you about that. And then talk a little bit about our situation, remind you of our financial picture. You had a significant financial update a few months ago, and we just want to refresh that discussion so that puts things into context as we move forward. I now want to turn it over to Brian Pirick, our city attorney.
Oh, thank you, Jim. I wanted first to describe for you a little bit about the Burke Williams and Sorensen Labor Group, and then I'll give you a little more information about Kelly Traynor, who's here this evening to make a presentation to you. The Labor and Employment Group of Burke Williams and Sorensen consists of 34 attorneys. They work primarily out of our offices in Los Angeles, Menlo Park, and Orange County. The clients of this group include cities, counties, corporations, small businesses, nonprofit entities, educational entities, and special district. The Labor and Employment Group handles all areas of labor and employment law and has expertise in litigation, counseling, labor negotiations, investigations, and training. Kelly Traynor, seated to my extreme left here, is one of the stars in our labor and employment group. She graduated with a bachelor's degree in political science from the University of Houston in 1998. I believe she'll be rooting for the University of Texas this evening. She received her Juris Doctorate degree in 2001 from the University of the Pacific McGeorge School of Law, and she is admitted to practice in both California and Texas. Kelly joined Burke in 2003, and during that time, her practice has been almost entirely on public labor and employment matters. She works with most of our cities, including the city of Atascadero. She has represented and advised cities on matters involving numerous federal and state law claims, including discrimination, harassment, wrongful termination, labor negotiations, wage and hour, leaves of absence, freedom of speech and association, privacy, the Myers-Milius-Brown Act, the public issues, including harassment, leave of absence, and others. And this training has included sessions with the California Joint Powers Insurance Authority, which we all know as the CJPIA, of which the city of Atascadero is a member. So that's about our firm's labor practice and about Kelly in particular. So I'll turn it back over to Jim and Kelly.
All right. So thank you so much. I'm very pleased to be here tonight. Is that good? All right. Well, let us jump right in and go on and get started. We're going to start tonight with a little bit of an overview of some of the laws and the roles of all the different parties in labor negotiations, as well as, Jim said, an overview of the contracts that are currently in place here in Atascadero. Starting first with roles, we have three major parties that we deal with in labor negotiations: the city council, the management, and then employees and the unions that represent those employees. Starting first with the City Council, generally speaking, during labor negotiations, the Council's focus during labor negotiations is really on the big picture of negotiations from the City perspective and really what it is that the City is trying to accomplish each fiscal year whenever they come back to the table for labor negotiations. It's the role of the Council to set the parameters and the policies that you want your negotiation team to try to accomplish each year whenever they sit down at the table with your employee groups. Ultimately, the Council holds the authority as the ultimate decision maker and has the authority to approve any contracts that are put together at the table by your negotiation team. But the day-to-day handling, you've kind of, generally speaking, that's been designated to your city manager as your employee relations officer who leads the city negotiation team through the day-to-day prospects in dealing with labor negotiations. Which turns us to management. The city's negotiation team for labor relations consists of three employees, your city manager, your assistant city manager, and your director of administrative services. Jim is the assistant city manager. He acts as lead negotiator for the city at the table and handles a lot of the primary burden of labor negotiations on behalf of the city. They are empowered by the council to deal with the unions at the table and negotiate on behalf of the city to reach agreements with the employee organizations. And then, of course, the third part of labor negotiations are the employees and the unions. Each different union has a different negotiation team that's structured differently depending on how each union likes to set up their own negotiation teams, can be made up of employees that are within that bargaining group in the city, as well as sometimes with outside bargaining representatives and sometimes with attorneys if they have attorneys that come to the table as well. The employees that serve on the labor negotiation teams are given what's called release time during labor negotiations to sit at the table. And then on to a little bit of a just kind of a very general legal review of some of the laws that we deal with in labor negotiations. The biggest one is the Myers-Milius-Brown Act in California, the MMBA for short. It's a very old law here in California. It was adopted in 1968. It sets forth all of the state parameters on labor relations for municipalities, for cities and counties. It has authorized the adoption of local rules for the agencies, which is a rather unique thing in public sector labor relations for cities and counties. In other areas of public sector employment, such as higher education and secondary education, the government code is very specific as to the rules and regulations that govern. For cities and counties, it's not so much the government code as it is regulations that get adopted locally by the city council, by board of supervisors in a county. And so a lot of rules are very local whenever we deal with municipal labor relations. One of the big changes we had under the MMBA was in 2001, and it changed the way that the MMBA is enforced. Prior to 2001, any alleged violation of the MMBA was enforced through the legal system, the courts, and employees who felt like their union rights had been violated were required to go to the superior courts in California. In 2001, that changed whenever our legislature amended the MMBA to place it under the jurisdiction of the Public Employment Relations Board, or PERB, and which is a state administrative agency that administers the MMBA now and is the first body you go to if there's any alleged violation of the MMBA. That applies to all groups of employment except for peace officers and for management employees. It was a specific exception to that amendment, so any violations alleged by a management employee or by a sworn officer or the union representing them, they are still required to go directly to court. So that is our big law that we deal with. Some of the other laws that we deal with in the public sector, the big two that aren't strictly speaking labor relations statutes but that are very specific to public employment are the Public Safety Officers and the Firefighters Procedural Bill of Rights, which contain a number of very unique protections and obligations for sworn public safety officers and more recently for firefighters. And so while they're not specific to labor relations and negotiations, they're always laws that we always have in the back of our mind whenever we're going through the process of labor negotiations with those groups. And then, as I mentioned, the MMBA authorizes cities and counties to adopt their own local rules. So Atascadero labor law is just as relevant and as important to the process as what the state law is. And Atascadero's rules and regulations on this come from a number of sources. The first and obviously the primary one is the municipal code and each of the labor groups individually. In addition to that, there is a resolution in Atascadero, Resolution 31-81, that sets forth impasse procedures. That is something very important in labor negotiations, and we'll get to that in just a little bit. The other rules that we deal with quite frequently are the memoranda of understanding. There are four in Atascadero that are the negotiated agreements with each of the four bargaining units in Atascadero. And then most recently with Resolution 2009-48, which the Council adopted last year, that sets forth the terms and conditions of an employment for the unrepresented employees, the management staff, and the confidential employees. So with that in mind, some of the key parts of all of those laws together, a little bit of the overview of the collective bargaining process, the negotiation process. Ideally, negotiations has five steps. It starts with one of the parties either requesting to begin negotiations or with both parties just mutually agreeing that it's time to start negotiations. After that, the parties meet and confer. They talk in good faith and negotiate and try to come to agreement. Once they reach a tentative agreement, it then goes to the union members who ratify that contract, and then it would be presented to the City Council to approve the contract. That would be our ideal situation. It is always the situation in the process that both sides, I think, hopes for whenever the negotiation process starts, but sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes there are hiccups in that process. Sometimes there are challenges in that process. The biggest part of the ideal negotiations is underlined, the negotiation in good faith. That is the key to good labor relations. And some of the, it's derived from the MMBA, from Government Code Section 3505, which sets forth the obligation, so it is a state law. It has been developed over the years to give us a little bit more of a practical perspective on what it means to say meet and confer in good faith. Some of the practical ways that we've seen that over the years and some of the hallmarks of really good faith negotiations from both sides is, first and foremost, establishing and adhering to ground rules. Ground rules are typically one of the first things that happens at the table whenever the two parties sit down. They set the rules for the negotiations. You know, how do proposals get exchanged between us? Do they have to be in writing? How do we memorialize a tentative agreement? Things of that nature. And having those ground rules written down and agreed to so that you know the rules of the game, so to speak. The exchange of proposals is also a very crucial part of negotiating in good faith, just having the back and forth take between the two sides and giving the proposals, considering the proposals. In looking at those proposals, having a true attempt to reconcile the differences between the two positions, between management and the union, to agree. There are times whenever parties can't reach an agreement. There are times whenever a party has a legitimate reason they don't want to make concessions, and you're not required to. You're just required to attempt to reconcile those differences. Some of the other things that we look at is, especially in public sector labor relations, where it's a very unique setup where you require the approval of a city council before you can approve a contract, and certainly the union needing to get the approval of its union members to ratify their contract. The negotiators that come to the table, while they don't have the absolute authority to sign off on that agreement, they need to come to the table with enough authority to be able to negotiate with the other side, to know what the parameters are that have been set by their bodies so that they can go forward and they can have real give and take at the table with the other side. One of the other big things that's especially a burden that's placed on the employer primarily is whenever you get a request for information from the unions. A lot of times information that unions need in order to represent their members is information that the public agency has in its records. Salary information, budget information, things of that nature. And one of the hallmarks of good faith negotiation is providing non-confidential information, certainly, whenever it's requested by the union and it's relevant and reasonable to the negotiations. Always with negotiations, you want to make sure that you are promptly negotiating and not trying to delay the process. Certainly, at times, labor negotiations can be a lengthy process, but you know, recognizing that it can take a while to go through the process, you just want to make sure you're not just playing a game and you're actually trying to move the ball down the field a little bit. When you're making your proposals, I always think that it's a very good idea that proposals be based on objective data so that you can give a why you're making this proposal, why you're taking this position, why you're not agreeing to change your mind on this particular position. The objective data, the finances, the budget, the morale in the city, anything that you can point to that gives you the support so that you're not just taking a position for the sake of taking a position, that there is a reason for the position. One of the things that we will talk about a little bit more specifically is making unilateral changes to matters within the scope of representation. It's something you always want to avoid to be engaged in good faith negotiations, so I'll kind of bookmark that to come back with later. And then one of the other issues is making sure that the negotiation happens between the negotiation teams. You don't want to directly deal with the employees or have employees that are directly dealing with somebody that's not on the city's negotiation team. The specific people who have been designated by the city council and by the union to negotiate on behalf of their respective groups need to be the people who the negotiation happens. In the city's resolution, which is one of the ones that I mentioned to you, is one of Atascadero's labor laws. Those are the procedures that we follow once there is an impasse and there is an order that you go through. The first part in impasse is that the side that believes they've reached an impasse needs to declare that they think there's been an impasse and that they are now moving to the point that they are going to be invoking the impasse procedures. The next step in that is that along with it, they have to state the reasons they feel that there is an impasse, what it is that is causing the breakdown of negotiations. And then they need to review with the other side the issues that have resulted in the impasse, what it is that got us to the point that we are right now. After we've done that, the second step is to schedule what's called the final impasse resolution meeting, which is a meeting at the table between the city's and the union's negotiation team where they sit down and they talk and they identify the issues that are there and they make kind of that last-ditch effort to try to salvage the negotiations and come to an agreement on whatever issue or issues it is that they have been stuck on. If they are unable to reach agreement, then we obviously go to step three. Step three has two different options. The parties can either mutually agree to submit the matter to mediation, where a mediator will come in and privately meet with the parties and resolve the matter, or the matter can be submitted directly to the City Council. If the matter is directed to the City Council for a resolution, the City Council has 21 working days from the date that the final impasse resolution meeting was held to hold a public meeting, in which it will hear from both the city's negotiation team as well as from the union's negotiation team. We'll hear both the presentations, the positions on the union issues, and then the city council is given 30 days to meet and decide how they are going to resolve the impasse. The time frame for that decision can be extended if it's deemed necessary and if you notify all the parties of your decision to extend that. After you've completed impasse procedures, we then move back to the government code and the MMBA, which instructs us what to do next. The next step of impasse is that once you've gone through all those process, you have the authority as a city council to implement what is called the last, best, and final offer. And it is a unilateral implementation of terms and conditions of employment. It's a very unique thing in the public sector, and it can be, quite honestly, a little bit confusing sometimes for people. The terms and conditions that you adopt last for one fiscal year. Unilateral implementation does not create a contract with the union. It just imposes terms and conditions that will govern their employment for the remaining part of that fiscal year. At the end of that fiscal year, the city is then obligated to meet and confer with the city again to try to come to a new contract that will then govern in the next place. The other really interesting thing about imposing a last, best, and final offer is that if there are issues that were within the scope of representation, issues that were within the MOU, the contract between the union and the city, that were not part of the last, best, and final offer, they continue through. So, for example, if one of your unions, if you went through impasse procedures and you were going to unilaterally implement last, best, and final position, and sick leave is an issue that is addressed in the MOU but was not subject to the last, best, and final offer, the provisions on sick leave that are in the MOU will carry forward for the remaining part of the year so that those rules are still in place and the city and the union are both still required to follow them. Now, with that, talking about going through the negotiation process, kind of the next logical step is what you're actually negotiating about. And the things that must be negotiated are not everything. There are some things that do not have to be negotiated. The buzz phrase that we use to describe it is that employers are obligated to negotiate before making changes to matters within the scope of representation. The scope of representation is what we look at to determine what is or is not something you have to negotiate with your union. As defined by the MMBA, the scope of representation includes very broadly wages, hours, and other terms and conditions of employment. It's a very broad statement. The only limitation on that that is in the statutory text is that it does not include merits, necessity, or organization of a service or activity provided by law or executive order. Those are the historic management rights. That's a phrase that employers hear a lot. That's my management rights, my management prerogative. There are a limited number of true management rights and management prerogatives that do not have to be negotiated with an employee organization before making changes to them. Again, a little bit more practical side of what the law says, some examples. Wages is obviously one of the largest areas within the scope of representation, includes anything that touches on a wage. Rate of pay, overtime pay, reduction of hours, insurance benefits, everything that has to do with an insurance benefit, level, contributions, all within the scope and have to be negotiated. Hours is another very broad area of something within the scope and includes schedules, reassignment of overtime, leaves, holidays, rest and meal periods. All of that is within the scope to be negotiated. It also includes safety, retirement benefits for your current employees, uniforms and equipment. If you decide to contract unit work out, that's also included. Use of volunteers and performance evaluation procedures. All examples of things that are within the scope to be negotiated. Now, the flip side of that, things that are outside of the scope that don't have to be negotiated. As you will see, a lot of things that are outside of the scope get limited to the decision. There is an area of law called effects bargaining, which comes up whenever you're dealing with management decisions. One of the biggest management decisions is the decision to lay off. The actual decision to lay employees off is a management right, and you do not have to negotiate the decision to lay off staff. The city is required, however, to negotiate the effects of that decision and the effects that it has on the bargaining unit. For example, timing, which employees are going to be affected, seniority and bumping rights, reclassification, those are issues that you have to negotiate. Similar to a decision to lay off is the decision to temporarily furlough, because it is somewhat like just a short-term layoff. That also is a management right, but the effects have to be negotiated with the bargaining unit. Again, decision to reorganize or create or abolish classes. The decision is a management right. The effects still have to be negotiated with the union. Assignment of duties, same thing. Effects of assignments of duties have to be negotiated. Retirement benefits for retirees is outside of the scope. And compliance with the law, unless the employer has discretion under a law that involves a negotiable subject. So if the city is required by a state or federal law to act in a certain way, you don't have to negotiate following the law, because you're just required to follow the law and you can't negotiate your way around a law. But if there is some discretion, for example, you know, the city is required to prohibit harassment in the workplace by law. You can't contractually agree to permit harassment in the workplace. But you can negotiate with your unions about disciplinary procedures or about investigatory procedures, things that would affect an area within the scope of representation, maybe something you have to meet and confer with your unions before making changes about. As I mentioned, one of the big areas that we deal with is unilateral action, which is what happens whenever an employer or a union, but generally speaking an employer, makes a change to a matter that is within the scope of representation without having given the other side notice of your intent to make that change and a reasonable opportunity to request negotiations over the effect that that change is going to have on their members. That is one of the hallmarks of good faith negotiations, is not making decisions before you have spoken to your representative organizations about that. So they have the opportunity to negotiate on behalf of their members. Taking a unilateral action about something within the scope, for example, if you just changed everybody's salaries without negotiating with the unions about that, that would be a unilateral action. It is considered an unfair labor practice, which can result in a charge being filed with PERB or an action being filed in the civil courts if we're dealing with police or management. Unilateral action is not unilateral implementation. And we do always kind of like to make that distinction because the phrases are very similar, and the idea behind unilateral implementation, because it is a unilateral action by the city, gets a little confusing. So whenever we talk about unilateral implementation of the last, best, and final offer after impasse procedures have been gone through, that is not a unilateral action. So we do like to make the distinction between the two. Now, a little review of the contracts in Atascadero and what currently is in place for all of your employee organizations. First and foremost, the city has four represented employee associations: the Atascadero Professional Firefighters, the Police Association, the SEIU Local 620, and the Midge Management Professional Employee Association. You also have an unrepresented group, which are your management employees and your confidential, who their terms are set forth, as you know, in a resolution. Now, generally, to go through, hopefully kind of quickly, because there's a lot of information in the contracts, through each of the contracts and some of the high points of what are in the contracts right now. First, your firefighters. Their current contract was a three-year contract that began on July 1st, 2007, and will be expiring at the end of this fiscal year. Their salary increases have been provided for over the last 3 years for each fiscal year. Last year, however, the firefighters did agree to defer their increase, so they received a 0% increase last year. Their overtime includes their paid leave as hours worked, and they are permitted to convert overtime into compensatory time off, which is a special benefit in the public sector. It's something we don't see in the private sector, where public employees are eligible to create time off from overtime worked, which is something that all of your employees have the rights under their MOUs. There are additional compensations and reimbursements for your firefighters that are set forth in the MOU. I'm not going to read them all to you. Sick leave is also provided for in each of your MOUs. It accrues per pay period and without limitation. Each of your bargaining groups has a limit at which, whenever they reach a number of hours, they can sell back up to one-third of their sick leave so that they're able to convert that. And then each of your provision, your contracts provides for retirement benefits. For fire, it's 3% at 50, which is the standard public safety retirement provisions. There's also health and life insurance provided for in all of the contracts. And then on to the police. The police had a one-year contract for this current fiscal year that will be expiring on June 30th of this year. Their salary increase last year was a 0% increase. They also have provisions on overtime and some enhanced increase to their pay if they have a post certificate. Some additional compensation is also provided for in the police. And incentive pay and uniforms covered in their MOU as well, as well as these additional compensation and reimbursement provisions. Their sick leave is similar to the firefighters, and their CalPERS is also 3% at 50. Health and life insurance, very similar to fire. And then SEIU. SEIU's list of represented classes, a little bit longer than everybody else's. They also had a one-year contract with a 0% salary increase last year. Their additional compensation and reimbursement provisions also set forth in their MOU. Sick leave is similar, again, to police and fire. CalPERS retirement is 2.5% at 55. Health and life insurance provided for SEIU members as well. And then for your mid-management and your supervisory association, again, represented classifications. They also had a one-year contract last year expiring the end of this fiscal year. Again, they took a 0% salary increase last year. Something different in the mid-management and supervisory is the provision for administrative leave, which is a normal provision that we see now in a lot of public sector employers, where your exempt employees who are not eligible to earn overtime are given a certain amount of paid leave, administrative leave, that is to sort of compensate them for the extra hours that they put in without overtime compensation. Sick leave also provided for under this contract, as well as CalPERS retirement, again, 2.5 at 55. Health and life insurance also provided. And then your management and confidential employees who are, again, not represented by a union, their terms are set by the council in a resolution. The current resolution was adopted last July and runs through the end of fiscal year 2011. The represented classifications are broken into three groups: executive management, which your city manager and your department heads, your management employees, and your confidential employees. The confidential employees are those employees who have access to labor negotiations information and play a role in the labor negotiations process, and their access to confidential information makes them qualified to be outside of the bargaining units. That's one of the provisions under the MMBA. Salary increases for management and confidential. There was a 0% increase for management and confidential, and last year your executive management team took a 3% salary reduction, and in exchange for that they've received 62 hours of additional administrative leave to compensate them for that giving up a part of their salary. There are both overtime and administrative leave provisions in the resolution because there are both exempt and non-exempt employees that are eligible to earn overtime and not eligible to earn overtime. There's a deferred compensation plan for your executive management and management teams. Health insurance is provided for. Sick leave, very similar to all of the other contracts. Life insurance, education uniforms, again, similar to your other contracts. CalPERS retirement, 2.5 at 55. Retiree health for your executive management is provided for in the resolution. And then, just very, very quickly, some of the historic wage information from 2004 through the end of this fiscal year. The wage increases that have been granted that accumulate for police and fire, they range between 30% and 35% increases for employees within those bargaining units, depending on a number of factors. For all other groups, for SEIU mid-management, as well as for your non-represented employees, since 2004, salary has increased between 21 and 26%. The other thing that we wanted to talk a little bit about is that, you know, certainly right now there is a lot of news coverage about the state of our economy in the United States, certainly the state of our economy in the state of California. And just, you know, as a sort of reminder of some of the things that we're seeing, I think a lot of times we hear a lot about the state, not so much about our fellow cities and counties and, you know, other districts. And so we just pulled a couple of the headlines off just to see some of the things that we are seeing in labor negotiations right now around California. From Santa Barbara City employees who had unpaid time off, they were furloughed through the end of 2009 as a plan to save about $3 million for the city, so they had unpaid time off to close out the year. Starting this year, Santa Maria City employees are all taking about a 5% pay cut. Most of that's going to be through furlough time. They're taking the third Friday off of every month, as well as Veterans Day. Police and fire, however, just took a straight pay cut to deal with that. Santa Maria is hoping it's going to save them about $1 million this year. They also announced at the end of 2009 that there are 11 library workers in San Luis Obispo City County libraries that are going to be being laid off because of a lack of funds in that city. Tracy, the police officers there are dealing with the possibility of layoffs, $9 billion deficit in Tracy. And the president of the union here saying, you know, he hopes to reduce job losses by giving up pay raises and implementing furloughs, making other concessions, which is something that we have seen around the state is cooperation between labor groups and management trying to come together to work for ways to find solutions to these problems and hopefully save jobs as much as you can in the process. And for a lot of agencies, you've seen a lot of cooperation from that. And then Fresno, again, taking a furlough at the end of the year through New Year's, which equaled about a 2% pay reduction for them to help with their budget issue as well. And then back to Jim now.
Thank you, Kelly. With that overview, as we start to wrap this up, we wanted to remind you of our city's financial condition and how that really relates to labor relations and the piggy bank. This chart you had seen a few months ago. What I want to try and share with you is this is 7 years of projections that the council accepted as our projected revenues and expenses. And I think what's important to show was we had a $1.6 million loss closing the fiscal year last year. Now, that was part of our financial plan that you've heard about, assuming that loss in tough times, putting some money away in good times. And you can see, using the budget projections, we expect an $800,000 loss this year. That was looking to be $1 million or so, but we've tightened up. The employees have really worked hard to tighten operations. You directed some changes to reduce expenses, and so you see that. You see a $1 million loss in 2012, and then we believe that revenues will start changing, and you see those losses shrinking to a positive number in 2016. And so your situation, you would still have over nearly $5 million in the general fund balance, which we believe is a prudent balance. And so that's the 7-year financial summary. What we really want to try and share with that is just a quick overview of what your assumptions are and your forecasting. Sales tax, we have taken our major hits. We believe that we'll start seeing some growth in the sales tax in 2013, but the next few years we believe sales tax will be largely flat. Of course, the movie theater, Rite Aid, Walmart, Tractor Supply, the many projects we have will help, and that's what we're showing in 2013 as we have growth. Property tax, for the first year in the city's history, remember, was negative last year, and that was a huge hit to the general fund. That's a major revenue source for the city, and we believe that that will continue to be flat through 2012-13, and I think that we haven't seen a lot of growth in homes quite yet. Our labor cost assumptions that we have through this period is that the chilled positions that have been frozen and the positions that have laid off continue to remain so. We do have increases to health insurance and PERS rates, but we have not included raises over the next 5 years in the budget. And you can see in the financial summary there still are negative years even with those assumptions. The state, we assume that the grabs will lessen because they've pretty much taken everything. There's one more revenue that they can take that is clearly unconstitutional, and we will continue to fight that. We have court battles at the state right now, the cities, and we believe these will lessen. We believe will prevail in the RDA lawsuit, and that the new initiative is on the street, and we'll be talking to you at that later date, that would protect all local government revenues. It's a much stronger Prop 1A that prevents any takes in the future. The reserves, we are according to plan, it's a responsible use of the reserves, and they will begin to rebuild after 6 years. And so that is what you had them for. Our budget estimates are very conservative, but we believe they're prudent at a time like this, and they're the estimates you approved. You have made sound and difficult budget decisions. We wanted to remind you of that. We showed you headlines of cities making these tough decisions. You've made those decisions as well, and we could have showed headlines for our own city. The budget is balanced today. And it's in good shape with the assumptions that you have in place. This is, remember, we had a $3.5 million gap last year. You implemented layoffs and hiring chills. We have not expanded or issued any new programs here at the city. We have restricted travel for all employees. We have cost-cutting across all departments, and the employees have been very innovative. And we are very pleased with the staff that they've come up with great ideas and ways to generate new revenue. We had an employee budget committee that really did a great job. And the city managers reviewed all department services and operations and made reductions where necessary. So where does this leave us? Our next steps, we are doing the strategic planning, as you see this part of this evening, planning with you. We will begin meeting with our employees very shortly after an information meeting. We want to share this information with them as well, so we're all on the same page. Again, that's a good symbol of good negotiations. At that point, we'll begin meeting and conferring with all of our bargaining groups that you saw this evening that we hope to negotiate new memorandums of understanding within budget constraints that we just discussed and within a good time frame, and we'd hope to have those approved. And so that's where we're headed. I think with that, we're available for any questions you may have.
Any questions?
I have no question. I'm overwhelmed.
Go ahead, Jerry. Councilmember O'Malley?
Well, I just wanted to thank both of our attorneys. She's with your firm, huh?
Well, I'm with her firm.
So. Oh, okay. Well put. Well, very good job, and thank you for that thorough presentation.
No, I think there's no questions among us. Should we open this to public comment then? If you would like to speak to the council, please approach the podium at this time. Seeing none, I'm going to close the public comment period. And this states on our agenda that you'd like us to give you some direction. Will that be after the closed session?
Yeah, in the closed session.
Very good. So at this point, we're going to adjourn to closed session, and we will return. Call the council back to open session, and I would like to have the city attorney address the closed session remarks.
Yes, there's nothing to report out of a closed session.
Very good. It says conference with labor negotiators. Where would you like to go with that, Wade?
That's what we had in closed session.
That's all it is.
Yep,
okay. Very good. At that point in time, I think we've covered it all for the evening, and I adjourn the meeting.